Part 3. The Reich Ascendant. Chapter 11. Rebuilding the Reich, American Style. With Kennedy dead and Lyndon B. Johnson in the White House, the Nazification of the United States moved ahead largely unhindered. During the Johnson years, the president was surrounded by a coterie of advisors, collectively known as his wise men. All were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. These included John J. McCloy, Averell Harriman, Dean Rusk, William Bundy, Dean Acheson, George F. Kennan, and Robert A. Lovett. By the early 1960s, the Council on Foreign Relations, Morgan and Rockefeller interests, and the intelligence community were so extensively interbred as to be virtually a single entity, remarked Professor Donald Gibson. With young people, the media, and members of Congress fixated on the Vietnam War, few people were aware of the growing power and influence of the military and the immense war machine assembled behind it. Not that this war machine was designed to actually win battles. On the contrary, it was designed to suck tax dollars from the public treasury, centralize power in the government and its corporate sponsors, and spread the new Reich's influence across the globe. Under the banner of freedom and democracy, yet pursuing the agenda of the globalists who supported the Nazis, the United States slowly turned from one of the most admired nations in the world to one of the most despised. William Blum, a former State Department employee turned author, stated, "From 1945 to 2003, the United States attempted to overthrow more than 40 foreign governments and to crush more than 30 populist nationalist movements fighting against intolerable regimes. In the process, the U.S. bombed some 25 countries, caused the end of life for several million people, and condemned many millions more to a life of agony and despair." The result of America's empire-building national policy has been dismal at best and catastrophic at worst. Putting aside the historical aggression displayed by American foreign policy in the Mexican War of 1848 and the Spanish-American War of 1898, a series of misguided foreign policy adventures since the arrival of thousands of Nazis following World War II includes: in 1953, a few years after Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh engaged in a gradual and lawful nationalization of the oil industry in that Mideast nation, he and his democratic government were deposed by a coup instigated by the CIA. This brought the Shah to power, with the monarchy assuming complete control in 1963 and turning Iran into a client state of the United States. Thousands of Iranians, perhaps millions, died during the repressive rule of the Shah and his brutal Savak secret police. The Shah was finally forced out in 1979 by the Ayatollah Khomeini, who quickly became the United States' latest foreign enemy, despite the fact that he had been on the CIA payroll while living in Paris. The Shah was granted asylum in the United States, and a medieval version of Islam took control over Iran, which by 2007 was again a targeted enemy. In 1954, the CIA toppled the popularly elected government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, which had nationalized United Fruit property. Prominent American government officials such as former CIA Director Walter Bedell Smith, then CIA Director Alan Dulles, Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs John Moores Cabot, and Secretary of State John Foster Dulles were all closely related to United Fruit. An estimated 120,000 Guatemalan peasants died in the resulting military dictatorships. Fidel Castro, with covert aid from the CIA, overthrew the military dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista in 1959 and instituted sweeping land, industrial, and educational reforms, as well as nationalizing American businesses. He was swiftly labeled a communist, and the CIA organized anti-Castro Cubans, which resulted in numerous attacks on Cuba and the failed Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. The island nation has been the object of U.S. economic sanctions since that time. In 1965, more than 3,000 persons died in the wake of an invasion of the Dominican Republic by U.S. Marines. The troops ostensibly were sent to prevent a communist takeover, although later it was admitted that there had been no proof of such an attempt. Also in 1965, the United States began the bombing of North Vietnam after President Lyndon B. Johnson proclaimed the Civil War there an aggression by the North. 2 years later, American troop strength in Vietnam had grown to 380,000, and soon after, climbed to more than 500,000. U.S. dead by the end of that Asian war totaled some 58,000, with casualties to the Vietnamese, both North and South, running into the millions. In 1973, the elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile was overthrown by a military coup aided by the CIA. Allende was killed, and some 30,000 persons died in subsequent violence and repression, including some Americans. Chile was brought back into the sphere of influence of the United States and remained a military dictatorship for the next two decades. In 1968, General Sukarno, the unifier of Indonesia, was overthrown by General Suharto, again with aid from the CIA. Suharto proved more dictatorial and corrupt than his predecessor. Some 800,000 persons reportedly died during his regime. Another 250,000 persons died in 1975 during the brutal invasion of East Timor by the Suharto regime, aided by the U.S. government and Henry Kissinger. In 1979, the powerful and corrupt Somoza family, which had ruled Nicaragua since 1937, was finally overthrown, and Daniel Ortega was elected president. But CIA-backed Contra insurgents, operating from Honduras, fought a protracted war to oust the Ortega government, and an estimated 30,000 people died. The ensuing struggle came to include such shady dealing in arms and drugs that it created a scandal in the United States called Iran-Contra, which involved persons connected to the National Security Council selling arms to Iran, then using the profits to buy drugs in support of the Contras. All of those indicted or convicted of crimes in this scandal were pardoned by then-President George H.W. Bush. In 1982, U.S. Marines landed in Lebanon in an attempt to prevent further bloodshed between occupying Israeli troops and the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Thousands died in the resulting civil war, including hundreds of Palestinians massacred in refugee camps by right-wing Christian forces, while Ariel Sharon, then an Israeli general, looked on with apparent approval. Despite the battleship shelling of Beirut and the destruction of the great Mediterranean city, American forces were withdrawn in 1984 after a series of bloody attacks on them. More than two decades later, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians remains as intractable and deadly as ever, in large part due to the virtually unconditional support of Israel by the United States, which has been sustained by the Israel lobby. In 1983, U.S. troops invaded the tiny Caribbean island nation of Grenada after a leftist government was installed. The official explanation was to rescue a handful of American students who initially said they did not need rescuing. The only real damage inflicted in this tiny war was to a mental health hospital partly owned by a White House physician and widely reported to be a CIA facility, possibly used for mind control experiments. During the 1970s and 1980s, the U.S. government gave aid and arms to the right-wing government of the Republic of El Salvador, which represented the financial interests of a tiny oligarchy, for use against its leftist enemies. By 1988, some 70,000 Salvadorans had died. More than 1 million persons died in the 15-year Battle of Angola between the Marxist government aided by Cuban troops and the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, supported by South Africa and the U.S. government. When Muammar al-Qaddafi tried to socialize the oil-rich North African nation of Libya, beginning with his takeover in 1969, he drew the wrath of the U.S. government. In 1981, it was claimed that Gaddafi had sent hit teams to the United States to assassinate President Reagan. And in 1986, following the withdrawal of U.S. oil companies from Libya, an air attack was launched, which missed Gaddafi but killed several people, including his infant daughter. In 1987, an Iraqi missile attack on the U.S. frigate Stark resulted in 37 deaths. Shortly afterward, the Iraqi president apologized for the accident. In 1988, a U.S. Navy ship shot down an Iranian airliner over the Persian Gulf, causing 290 deaths. The Reagan administration simply called it a mistake. As many as 8,000 Panamanians died over Christmas 1989 when President George H.W. Bush sent U.S. troops to invade that Central American nation to arrest one-time ally Manuel Noriega. The excuse was that the Panamanian dictator was involved in the importation of drugs to the United States. U.S. News and World Report noted that a year later, the amount of drugs moving through Panama had doubled. Iraqi casualties, both military and civilian, totaled more than 300,000 during the short Persian Gulf War of 1991. It has been estimated that more than 1 million Iraqis, including women and children, have died as a result of the continued missile and air attacks, not including those killed since the U.S. invasion of 2003, as well as of economic sanctions against that nation. Also in 1991, the United States suspended assistance to Haiti after the election of a liberal priest sparked military action and disorder. Eventually, U.S. troops were deployed. Once again in 2004, the United States fomented and backed the toppling of the democratically elected president and replaced him with an unelected gang of militarists, CIA operatives, and corporate predators. Other nations that have felt the brunt of CIA and/or U.S. military activity as a result of globalist foreign policy include Somalia, Afghanistan, Serbia, Kosovo, Bosnia, Brazil, Chad, Sudan, and many others. In early 1974, while President Nixon was desperately trying to find a way out of impending impeachment, G. Gordon Liddy, ringleader of the break-in at the National Democratic Party headquarters, was preoccupied with Nazi imagery. Liddy had named the Watergate Plumbers after the vast secretive organization that helped Nazis escape both Europe and justice after the war. Our organization had been directed to eliminate subversion of the secrets of the administration. So I created an acronym using the initial letters of those descriptive words. Odessa appealed to me because when I organize, I am inclined to think in German terms, and the acronym was also used by a World War II German veterans organization belonged to by some acquaintances of mine. Liddy wrote in his 1980 book, Will, The Autobiography of G. Gordon Liddy. According to author Edward J. Epstein in 1971, Liddy invited a number of White House officials to view Nazi propaganda films to demonstrate how a few determined men could manipulate the emotions of an entire nation by invoking a few highly visual symbols of fear. These Nixon officials included John Ehrlichman, Egil Kroc, Donald Santorelli, and Robert Mardian. The cycle of films was climaxed on June 13th by the showing of Triumph of the Will, a Nazi propaganda film made under the auspices of Hitler and Göring, which graphically depicted the way a national will could be inculcated into the masses through the agency of controlled fear and frenzied outrage, reported Epstein. Paul Manning noted, the German South American group also had direct access to the Nixon White House through their representatives in Washington and were proud of the fact that Bibi Rebozo was President Nixon's closest friend. For knowingly or unknowingly, Rebozo processed millions of their dollars through his Florida bank as part of normal commercial operations. And it was during Nixon's presidency that Prescott Bush's son, George Herbert Walker Bush, one of the last of Nixon's Republican loyalists, was named chairman of the Republican National Committee, RNC. With Nixon's resignation in August 1974, the United States entered a period of further turmoil. The Church Committee uncovered conspiracies, including assassination plots within the CIA, and recriminations started following the loss in Vietnam. Gerald Ford, a Republican insider, had been appointed vice president with the resignation of Spiro Agnew, who was under indictment for tax evasion. When Ford became president, he promptly pardoned Nixon of all crimes and, at the behest of his Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, appointed George H.W. Bush to head the CIA. At the time, most people could not understand Bush's appointment, having forgotten that his Nazi-connected grandfather, Senator Prescott Bush, had been one of those instrumental in establishing the CIA. Meanwhile, the globalists, realizing that the Republican Party, in the wake of Nixon's resignation, was politically vulnerable, were maneuvering to place a Democrat in the White House. They created an outgrowth of the old Council on Foreign Relations called the Trilateral Commission. The concept of the Trilateral Commission was brought to David Rockefeller in the early 1970s by Zbigniew Brzezinski, then head of the Russian Studies Department at Columbia University. While at the Brookings Institute, Brzezinski had been researching the need for closer cooperation between the trilateral nations of Europe, North America, and Asia. In a book titled Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era, Brzezinski foresaw a society that is shaped culturally, psychologically, socially, and economically by the impact of technology and electronics, particularly in the area of computers and communication. He also declared national sovereignty is no longer a viable concept and predicted movement toward a larger community by the developing nations through a variety of indirect ties and already developing limitations on national sovereignty. He saw this larger community being funded by a global taxation system, similar to one that is now being proposed in the United Nations. Brzezinski's plan for a commission of trilateral nations was first presented during a meeting of the ultra-secret Bilderberg Group in April 1972 in the small Belgian town of Knokke. Reception to Brzezinski's proposal reportedly was enthusiastic. The Trilateral Commission was officially founded on July 1, 1973, with David Rockefeller as chairman. Brzezinski was named founding North American director. North American members included Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter, U.S. Congressman John B. Anderson, another presidential candidate, and Time Inc. editor-in-chief Hedley Donovan. Foreign founding members included Reginald Maudling, Lord Eric Rohl, Economist editor Alistair Burnett, Fiat President Giovanni Agnelli, and French Vice President of the Commission of European Communities, Raymond Barr. Even the establishment-oriented media expressed uneasiness over the preponderance of trilaterals in government in early 1977. Columnist William Grider, writing in the Dallas Morning News, noted, "But here is the unsettling thing about the Trilateral Commission. The President-elect, Carter, is a member. So is Vice President-elect, Walter F. Mondale. So are the new Secretaries of State, Defense and Treasury, Cyrus R. Vance, Harold Brown, and W. Michael Blumenthal. So is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is a former trilateral director and Carter's national security advisor, also a bunch of others who will make foreign policy for America in the next 4 years. Anthony C. Sutton and Patrick M. Wood, authors of Trilaterals Over Washington, commented, "If you are trying to calculate the odds of three virtually unknown men, Carter, Mondale, and Brzezinski, out of over 60 trilateral commissioners from the United States capturing the three most powerful positions in the land, don't bother. Your calculations will be meaningless." Despite being a creation of the Rockefeller-dominated Trilateral Commission and following some of their aims, such as eliminating price controls for domestic petroleum production by establishing a national energy policy and further drawing power to the federal government by creating the Departments of Energy and Education, Carter apparently failed to satisfy the globalists. The mass media were already focusing on conservative California Governor Ronald Reagan as the man of the hour. Reagan's nomination as GOP presidential candidate for the 1980 election seemed assured. Carter asked for and was granted a national television spot during prime time, and many media pundits predicted that he was about to announce sweeping changes in government, as well as new initiatives that would move his upcoming presidential re-election campaign off high center. But before his televised appearance, Carter journeyed to California, where he was to address a Hispanic crowd in the Los Angeles Civic Center Mall celebrating Cinco de Mayo, the day the Mexicans defeated the French army in 1862. A few days later, a handful of newspapers carried a small story stating that a grubby transient had been arrested there and was being held on suspicion of the attempted assassination of the president. A Secret Service spokesman downplayed the arrest, stating the incident was about as nothing as these things get. However, a few days later, another news item appeared, which reported that the 35-year-old Anglo suspect was being held in lieu of $50,000 on charges of conspiring to kill the president. Finally, a one-time story in the May 21, 1979 edition of Newsweek revealed more details of the incident. According to the news magazine, the suspect was arrested after Secret Service agents noticed him looking nervous. A .22 8-shot revolver was found on the man, along with 70 rounds of blank ammunition. A short time later, the suspect implicated a second man, a 21-year-old Hispanic, who also was taken into custody and subsequently held in lieu of $100,000 bail. The second suspect at first denied knowing the other man, but finally admitted that the pair had test-fired the blank starter pistol from a nearby hotel roof the night before Carter's appearance. Both men said they were simply local street people hired by two hitmen who had come up from Mexico. They were to create a diversion with the blank pistol, and the two hitmen were to assassinate President Carter with high-powered rifles. Lending credence to their story, both suspects led authorities to the shabby Allen Hotel located near the Civic Center. Here, investigators found an empty rifle case and 3 rounds of live ammunition in a room that had been rented under the name Humberto Camacho. Camacho apparently had checked out the day of Carter's visit. No further trace of the hitmen could be found. The Anglo suspect's name was Raymond Lee Harvey, and his Hispanic companion's name was Osvaldo Ortiz. This oddity of their names prompted Newsweek reporters to state references to Lee Harvey Oswald and the assassination of President John F. Kennedy were unavoidable. But, they added, it was still far from clear whether the authorities had a real conspiracy or a wild goose chase on their hands. No further news stories appeared, and the disposition of the case against Lee Harvey and Osvaldo apparently has never been made. A recent search of the federal prisoner database indicated no such persons are currently incarcerated. But apparently, Carter got the message. He canceled his national TV speech and went into seclusion at Camp David. After seeking advice from a lengthy line of consultants, including the Reverend Billy Graham, Carter was reported to have said, "I have lost control of the government." Backing away from any serious policy changes, Carter remained indecisive in the public eye. By mid-November the following year, the United States took a conservative turn and elected Republican Ronald Reagan. Reagan's victory was due, in large part, to a failed military attempt to rescue U.S. hostages held by Iranian radicals, followed by the collapse of negotiations regarding their release in mid-October 1980. Reagan, a former spokesman for General Electric Company, stocked his administrations with current and former members of globalist groups, the very people he had criticized while campaigning. During the 1980 presidential campaigns, Reagan verbally attacked the 19 trilaterals in the Carter administration and vowed to investigate the group if elected. While competing against George H.W. Bush for the nomination, Reagan lambasted Bush's membership in both the Trilateral Commission and the CFR, and pledged not to give Bush a position in a Reagan government. Yet, during the Republican National Convention, a strange series of events took place. With Reagan secured as the presidential candidate, there was a contentious fight to see who would be vice president. In midweek, national media commentators suddenly began talking about a dream ticket to be composed of President Ronald Reagan and Vice President, the former president, Gerald Ford. It was even suggested that since Ford had been president, he should choose half of the Reagan cabinet. Faced with the prospect of a split presidency, Reagan rushed to the convention floor late at night and announced, "I know that I am breaking with precedent to come here tonight, and I assure you at this late hour I'm not going to give you my acceptance address tonight." But in watching at the hotel the television and seeing the rumors that were going around and the gossip that was taking place here, "Let me as simply as I can straighten this out and bring this to a conclusion. It is true that a number of Republican leaders felt that a proper ticket would have included the former President of the United States, Gerald Ford, as a second place on the ticket. I then believe that because of all the talk and how something might be growing through the night, that it was time for me to advance the schedule a little bit. I have asked, and I am recommending to this convention, that tomorrow when the session reconvenes that George Bush be nominated for Vice President." For one brief moment, the power of those who control the corporate mass media was revealed. Reagan never again uttered a word against the globalist groups such as the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations. Following his election, Reagan's 59-member transition team was composed of 28 Council on Foreign Relations members, 10 members of the elite Bilderberg Group, and at least 10 members of the Trilateral Commission. He even appointed prominent CFR members to three of the nation's most sensitive offices: Secretary of State Alexander Haig, Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, and Secretary of the Treasury Donald Regan. Eventually, he named Bush's campaign manager James A. Baker III, who then served as a chairman of the Reagan-Bush Campaign Committee, as his chief of staff. Baker is a fourth-generation member of a family long connected to Rockefeller oil interests. After Reagan won in November, it was alleged that Bush, along with CIA Director William Casey, had privately cut a deal with Iranian leaders to hold American hostages until after the November election, thus assuring a Reagan victory. Later testimony confirming this October surprise came from several people involved, including Richard Brennecke and Heinrich Rupp, who claimed to have flown Casey to a meeting with the Iranians and the Iranian foreign minister. Because of his damaging testimony, Brennecke was tried for perjury but found not guilty. Jury foreman Mark Kristoff said, "We were convinced that, yes, there was a meeting, and he was there, and the other people listed in the indictment were there." Despite this verdict, no action was taken by the Reagan-Bush administration, thanks primarily to debunking by a House task force led by Congressman Lee Hamilton, the same man Bush's son would name to co-chair his 9/11 commission in late 2002. On January 20, 1981, claims of this October surprise conspiracy were further supported by the facts that just minutes after Reagan was sworn into office, the American hostages were released, and within weeks, military supplies that Carter had withheld from Iran began moving to that nation. Then, just 2 months after taking office in 1981, President Reagan was shot by would-be assassin John W. Hinckley, who exhibited the symptoms of brainwashing and whose brother had scheduled dinner with Neil Bush the very day Reagan was shot. For many weeks, while many Americans prayed for Reagan's recovery, the son of Prescott Bush ran the nation. Bush had exerted his influence to have Alexander Haig appointed Secretary of State, and only days before the attempted assassination of Reagan had named Haig to head a Special Emergency Preparedness Committee. Haig, a ranking globalist member of the Council on Foreign Relations, was Nixon's chief of staff from 1973 to 1974. It was Haig who finally advised Nixon to resign. Haig was also NATO commander from 1975 to 1979. was it sheer coincidence that Hinckley's brother had scheduled dinner with Bush's son Neil the very night Reagan was shot, or that Hinckley's father, a Texas oil man, and George H.W. Bush were longtime friends? It should also be noted that Bush's name, including his then little publicized nickname, Poppy, which has caused many to wonder if this referred to his parenthood or the narcotic plant, address, and phone number were found in the personal notebook of oil geologist George de Morenschildt, the last known close friend of Lee Harvey Oswald. Many researchers view these seemingly small, unconnected, and little reported details as being beyond coincidence. Some saw Hinckley's action as an attempt to bring Bush to power 8 years before he was elected president. "This, I believe, was a coup," stated assassination researcher John Judge, co-founder of the Coalition on Political Assassinations, COPA. In a 2000 interview, Judge stated his belief that loyalists won the concession that Reagan will be allowed to stay alive, but Bush would come into power, and at that point, Haig emerged from the Situation Room to the press and said his famous quote, "Gentlemen, I am in charge here until the Vice President returns." This meant two things. Number one, that they were going extra-constitutional, beyond the 25th Amendment, a military takeover. And number two, Haig in this office of preparedness prior to Bush, and basically, he's taking charge. The press was questioning, what does this mean? What they don't understand is that all that constitutional stuff is pushed aside once they declare national emergencies. Then they go into FEMA, and they have whole other orders of succession that have to do more with the military and the Pentagon than with any of the civilian sector. Constitutionally, the next in line in the order of succession is the Vice President, then the Speaker of the House, then the Senate President pro tempore, then the Secretary of State. Vice President George H.W. Bush was flying from Texas at the time of Haig's proclamation. Hinckley was whisked off to Quantico Marine Base, then sent for psychiatric evaluation at Fort Butner, South Carolina, which Judge described as the first mind control experimentation prison in the country. All this time, Hinckley was under military control, not civilian. He was eventually brought to court and declared not guilty by reason of insanity for the assassination attempt. The patterns are always the same. You have a patsy that takes the blame. You have a second gunman that never comes to light. And you have an ascendance of power. That's what I think happened after that point, that Reagan was basically allowed to function, but Bush was president, said Judge. And Bush was virtually unassailable due to his hidden but powerful support base. Robert Perry, a former investigative reporter for the Associated Press and Newsweek, noted, "Even when, or maybe especially when, Bush found himself in a corner on what appeared to be an obvious lie, he was a master at turning the tables on his critics." Coming to Bush's defense was an impressive network of friends in high places. They rarely failed him. When that happened, it was wise not to ask too many questions.